The Money Show.
Business Unusual with Colin Cullis.
What have pandemics got to do with Business Unusual?
Well, we talk about disruption, and we tend to assume that that disruption is coming from some bright and sparkly new amazing technology thing. But given that this last weekend we marked the 31st anniversary of the world saying HIV is a real problem, and despite the progress, we're still a good couple of years away from actually saying we've now got a vaccine. And
we haven't got a cure, but we've managed to tame the beast. I mean, antiretroviral programs have become far more effective. The doses are far more friendly. People don't feel horrendous on the drugs. And people are having perfectly normal lives, taking carefully structured courses of antiretrovirals. We haven't beaten it, but it has beaten us.
It hasn't. And generally, I mean, we've been around now for a good couple of thousand years, and we're pretty good, and we've shown how resilient we are. But it doesn't mean it doesn't come at huge Jude's costs. And so this evening I wondered, might be a good opportunity to look at the kind of disruption that comes from a pandemic, because
there's a fabulous book which looks too thick for me to have sufficient time to read and to focus on. Rabbit. What? It's about the 1919 Spanish flu. And at the end of World War I, there was a global pandemic of influenza, which afflicted mostly women and almost restored the male-female balance in the world. It's one of those weird things that happened. And that was the last major global pandemic, I think.
No. That certainly is one of the high watermark ones, and yeah. I'm going to be giving you some more details about it. But they're ongoing, and for most of the experts, the question isn't if we'll have another pandemic to rival something as significant as that, just the question of when and how will we react. In fact, right now, there is a epidemic underway in Samoa of measles, a disease that we've actually had, or supposedly had, under control for years.
And then the nutty anti-vaxxers, watch my Twitter feed, nutty anti-vaxxers, yes, I said nutty anti-vaxxers, in really the developed parts of the world are going, no, I don't vaccinate my children because, I don't know, for whatever reason.
Well, that was exactly the cause that's been attributed to the outbreak there at the moment. A few years ago, there was a couple of deaths as a result of poorly administered vaccines, not a problem with the vaccines. And this is the thing, we come to believe that medical advances have made us safe, that if anything happens to us, we go and grab a pill and we'll be okay. But vaccinations don't work that way. And in fact, there's some of the terminology might be quite useful. So endemic diseases are ones where the viral loads, the cases of them occurring, is pretty stable. So the regular winter flus are kind of endemic. On occasions, though, we'll get a new strain or variety, or we wouldn't have seen it necessarily.
The H1...
Well, what the most famous one is the H1N1, and I'll touch on why they have these names. But then they become, when they increase beyond the normal numbers, that's an epidemic, spans into new regions. And a pandemic is when it effectively starts moving outside of countries and across continents. And the idea of, or how best to control outbreaks of diseases, long before we knew what a disease was, we knew that if you just isolated someone, basically just get them away from us, we wouldn't get infected. And we can thank the Venetians for being particularly controlling in this regard, that they controlled ports. When a ship arrived from a destination they believed to be high risk, they would make them wait at anchor for 40 days.
Quarantine.
Literally means 40 days.
Quarantine, yes.
Yes, quarantino. And the second word that we can thank the Italians for is the word itself, flu. It was believed that the thing that gave us the flu were astrological influences. And Italian for influence is influenza. And that's kind of stuck. And that big one, you're absolutely right to point out, occurred just after the First World War. And it had sort of the perfect storm for how it occurred. The first one maybe to say is the Spanish flu. So it came from Spain, right? No, it came from the US.
Obviously.
Well, and because the First World War was underway and America was sending troops, 2 million in all, across from America to Europe, the outbreak hadn't been fully understood or fully diagnosed in the US, but was able to start spreading. And because ships back in 1919 were capable of getting across the Atlantic in less than 40 days, those ships were effectively fantastic breeding grounds for the disease. Once people landed in Europe, they were exposed to a disease they had no resistance to, and it absolutely spread. The Spanish weren't part of the First World War, and so restrictions on reporting was a little less there. So it occurred more in newspapers, etc. And other people started referring to it by the coverage it got in Spanish press, and that how it became known as the Spanish flu. And you might have thought, well, once we dealt with that one, once that one burnt itself through the population, as it were, then everybody who survived had a sort of a resistance to it, and we'd be good. That is kind of true. That is how we build up resistances to viruses. But it came at a cost of between 50 and the upper estimates are 100 million people. That's more than the number of people who died in the First World War. And the challenge comes from how viruses work. And viruses and bacteria are two different things. Viruses, and certainly the flu virus, I'm just going to focus on that one for this evening, come in, well, four kinds. B and C types only affect humans. Type D affects only animals. But the type A virus is the one we're most concerned about because it can affect animals and us. And those H1N1 refer to the two kinds of ways that the virus itself is able to be identified. And it's there are 144 variations that they can occur in. You effectively have to contract each one of those before you can say you will not be affected by them. And so every year when somebody says you should go for your flu shot, you kind of think, but I've already done that. Why do I need to do it again? Well, every year there is a new mutation of it where the H and the N's possibly change. And then these are very clever viruses. They're the oldest living things on the planet, if you consider viruses living. And so they can remix their DNA, effectively making our bodies not that good at being able to identify what's going on. And in 2009, the H1N1 had another breakout in America. Now, globally, the UN World Health Organization have been very hard at work to ensure that we minimize the risk and we improve our way to respond to these diseases. But even then, in 2009, in less than a year, with them basically tracking that disease from the first person that was identified, over 60 million people got infected. A quarter million people wound up in hospitals, and over 12,000 people died from a virus we knew that had just changed a little bit. And this is the thing that is so difficult with this. We don't see it as a real threat. Ahead of the show, I asked, you know, what do you typically do when you get flu symptoms or when you get the flu? I gave you the option to say, stay home, work if you feel okay, get told to go home, or demand antibiotics. And while the majority, 38%, said stay home, it effectively means that the other two, 50% almost, said that either go to work if they feel okay or get told to go home, which means they are effectively...
They're spreading the problem.
They're spreading the problem without realizing. And the balance, the 15% who said they demand antibiotics, that was a bit of a trick question because viruses don't typically respond to antibiotics.
Ah, you sneaky devil. But most people feel a bit sick, so they demand antibiotics, even though the antibiotics will have no effect on that particular condition. But it is leading to this huge increase in antibiotic resistance, which is raising the risk of other diseases all over the place.
Exactly right. And actually, when you start affecting your own bacterial sort of makeup while you're suffering from a virus, you're potentially weakening your immune systems even further. Now, that's the kind of stuff that comes from the pure medical, biological kind of stuff. But if you consider, as I'm sure most business owners know only too well during winter time, how hard it is to keep enough people manning the phones or making the sales to keep the business going for a regular flu season, what the impact would be if you have a real big outbreak. In Samoa at the moment, they've shut the schools. They shut them back in November. They have banned, they've got a curfew from the 2nd of December. They have cancelled all public gatherings. I mean, it's coming up for Christmas. You kind of think there's a lot of people looking to get together. And even government offices have been told, we're going to have to shut this just to stop people getting around. The hospitals are overrun. They've had to get special emergency supplies of additional vaccinations, and they've now made it compulsory that you get vaccinated. And there is a very important thing that happens with vaccinations in that you need to have a certain number of people vaccinated for it actually to work. And once you trigger that special point, that is quite high, you get what's known as herd immunity. Effectively, you can protect everybody. And the point about having that, despite some people thinking, it's my choice, I want to do it, very young kids and very elderly in the weak can't get vaccinations because they do have an impact on us when we take them. By ensuring that the disease can't spread, you make it safer for them not to get it. Now, you might think, well, who would be able to advise us? Who should we take the word from on this? Well, Bill Gates is not somebody who hasn't had a chance to think about sort of these things. And he acknowledges environmental risks, economic collapse, nuclear disasters. All of these things he sees as being very real risks. But the probable risk, he reckons, and the one that is more imminent and will probably have the greatest impact for us, will be a pandemic of a virus that we right now simply are not setting aside sufficient funds for research. And
the thing is, when it comes, we wouldn't have seen it before. I mean, at the moment, we're terrified of Ebola, for example. Yeah. Ebola is a horrific disease, and there are occasional outbreaks in places like the DRC. Hans Rosling, have you read his book, Factfulness?
Yes.
So he, and also with this modern news flow happens faster than viruses spread. And I just got an extract from the book. And thousands of people died in a 2009 outbreak of swine flu. And Hans Rosling did some data analysis afterwards. And it was serious. It wasn't as bad as the Spanish flu of 1919. But over a two-week period, Rosling compared real data with public perceptions. And he analyzed during that time that 31 people had died of swine flu. And Google, when he went to Google, threw up 253,443 searches on swine flu. People were terrified of swine flu. So there was a lot spoken about and a lot written about swine flu. It was on the news. 24/7, it was there. During that time, though, 63,000 people died of TB.
Oh, yes.
And each swine flu death had the average of 8,176 articles, and each TB death had 0.1 articles per death. Because we make, you know, we also don't do ourselves any favors because we crying wolf a lot about these pandemics, and then nothing comes to pass. We stop treating them as seriously. And the next time there's a swine flu story, we go, it's not serious. I'm going to go and sit next to the person without the mask on my flight from Singapore.
Exactly right. In fact, there is a link I've put up online of a crowd who do data visualizations, and they plot all of the various highly infectious diseases by how contagious they are and how fatal they are. And one of the ways you can set the grid up is which ones get the most press and media and which ones should be getting the press and the media. Because the challenge isn't just for diseases like tuberculosis. It's a known thing that we need to do. But because it doesn't seem to be new, it doesn't get coverage. And so people sort of don't treat it with the kind of severity or the kind of attention it needs. But the challenge comes from this. They refer to it as a disease X. We know it's out there. It's some mutated version of a flu we haven't seen yet, typically. And the catch is that when that does happen, it is useful for the media to make sure everybody do not mess around, take this seriously. But what we need to do is now, while there isn't a major flu necessarily, is who is setting aside the money from those very tight budgets? Which businesses are holding or suggesting that they will be stumping up money for research to better prepare us when that comes? Stockpiling resources.
Human nature doesn't allow us to do it because, well, it's not a problem, so why should we worry? We'll worry when it's a problem, if it's ever a problem, and it won't be. Somebody else will fix it anyway.
Until it is.
Colin Cullis with Business Unusual this evening. Thank you, Colin.